You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
Clock this half an hour, we're going to be talking to Honorable Thando Tolo Jika, who of course is an investigative journalist and one of our country's best at the Mail and Guardian. And we're going to be talking in particular about the Commission of State Capture, the inquiry into state capture rather, which of course is an incredibly important moment for us as a country to be reckoning with the hollowing out of the state and the subversion, quite frankly, of our constitution. And I think one cannot underdescribe why it is significant, what is at play here. We still need to make sure that we have as much of the factual basis as possible established and that justice is done and seen to be done for you and for me as well. Thando Tolo, thanks so much for coming in. It's always wonderful having you on the show.
Always a pleasure, Eusebius. Thank you.
So there's so much going on, obviously, in the news cycle at the moment, right? So I thought one thing I wanted to do with you was to just sort of hit the pause button on this question, then we'll get into some of the specifics of what's come out so far. Because the public is confused, even those of us who are news hounds, it's not very, very clear to us, you know, what's the difference between this and the Nugent Committee? I'm going to speak to Paulie van Wyk about that a little bit later. So maybe we should start with the basics, first. Journalistically, as well as the amazing academics at places like Stellenbosch and institutions like Perry, civil society organizations, church organizations have done a pretty good job in that, in those spaces, to begin to put some of the pieces of the puzzle out in the public space over the last couple of years. Thus far, when it comes to this commission, how has the work of the commission complemented, corroborated, or even taken further what has already been established by investigative journalists like yourself and all our other peers across the media houses?
Well, look, I mean, at this stage and how the commission started, I can see that, you know, Judge Raymond Zondo tried to, you know, break this thing into chunks. You deal with a, you know, what the first person that was there was a person from the office of the Chief Procurement Office to just give a an overview of, you know, what procurement processes are, the laws, etc., for the benefit, of course, of the evidence leaders and, of course, for the judge. From the testimony that has come up right now from Cebisi Jonas, from Themba Maseko, from Faki Mentuo, and currently Sisiphumla Williams, you know, they're painting a picture of exactly some of the issues that we had raised as journalists in the, in all the articles, how procurement processes were flouted, how you know, people bent backwards, you know, to accommodate the Guptas, how the Guptas were also given an unfair advantage. They also had access, you know, to state budgets, and they also had a hand in, you know, who goes where, not only ministers, but also officials. You know, so the work that's unraveling right now is complementing much of what has been, you know, in the public domain.
And so of let's drill down on some of that then, right? So, I mean, you know, 10 years ago, we would have thought, who gives a damn about someone with such a boring title as procurement officer, right? Like, what do you, I mean, it just sounds utterly dull right up there with accounting. But the one thing that has emerged over the last couple of years with all the work that you guys have done, the fantastic books from people like Peter Louis Myburgh and Jacques Poe, et cetera, and we put it all together, is that actually there are some people within a particular part of the state that is critical to stealing. And the title of procurement officer is often the entry in there. What has come out with Willie Matebula in terms of understanding how systems break up and how systems can be manipulated for purposes of theft?
So, I mean, with Matebula, Matebula only just gave us how this, you know, why a procurement officer is important, etc. But the key for me is, you know, the office of the chief procurement officer in the Treasury, which was supposed to now review all contracts that were over 10 million, and how that office was consistently met with resistance from state-owned entities, from a number of departments, not to give documents to them. And basically, the whole process was now contaminated and they couldn't do their work. Of course, a procurement officer and a CFO are quite critical when it comes to these contracts. So what Matebula was just basically giving us in the beginning is, you know, how processes work, and I'm assuming, and this is where it is going, you know, to give evidence as to how laws were broken. For example, already Phumla Williams has given an indication of how that breakfast that was always done, the TNA breakfast that was done, it never followed any procurement processes. It was outside of whatever GCIS's processes were. And when it was supposed to have gone out to compete with the rest of other possible bidders, that thing didn't happen. And she clearly says that there was an illegal issue, and she was the acting head of the department and had no knowledge of the TNA breakfast. That's what she said.
The other interesting thing that came out of Matebula's remarks, of course, is sometimes we design systems in a complex way with good intentions because we think that we need to put in place maximum possibilities for oversight and for good governance. But you can also over-regulate, right? So you've got all these different pieces of acronyms. Some of them we've come to know quite well as South Africans, others not so well. Public Finance Management Act, Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act. Mm-hmm. Then you also have very particular Treasury regulations. Mm-hmm. And I thought one thing that was interesting that Willie had said is that perhaps by the time we come to the end of this thing, and I'm now looking forward, we'll come back to the details. We might have to talk about the importance of consolidating legislation and processes. So complexity may be there to try and minimize the crooks from being able to jump over the system. But on the other hand, complexity also plays into the hands of very clever crooks.
And he was quite right in the in that instance, and which is where Treasury became key and problematic in the end for the likes of the Guptas, because whenever contracts now needed to be approved and whatever, you needed Treasury to do that. There was all of a sudden this move to ask for deviation, and which was it was a way to say, actually, we just want the money, you know, we don't want to go the normal route of following procurement processes. Can you rubber stamp it? And Treasury was the stumbling block, hence the many changes that started happening. And I think that's what will then come out of the state.
Just as a sidebar, incredible. If there wasn't so much at stake in terms of our constitution, it would be funny, but it actually isn't funny. By definition, deviation is meant to be exceptional, but deviation became the norm.
It became
We need to pause over how weird that is.
Yeah.
Deviation means deviating from standard operating procedure. Yes, but here you have deviation practically becoming the norm.
Yes, which is, shocking, and which actually drove many, you know, Treasury officials to say, but hang on, now we are actually doing illegal things in these state-owned entities. You can't have deviations all the time.
Exactly.
There's no emergency. You have not tested the market, whether there's other bidders that are capable of providing the same service. And these deviations, you would see, and the pattern will also emerge in the inquiry,
that
they were happening in certain state-owned entities. Mm-hmm. And certain names will keep on coming up. I mean, constitutionally, I thought we were really, really being undermined, and when they didn't get their way, those who were close to President Jacob Zuma, they then started forcing people out of positions, and they were pushing very hard. I mean, that's why we ended up with a very chaotic situation in 2015, where you ended up having a Des van Rooyen in 4 days' time. The guy was gone. The next thing, he flies to Dubai for a 1-day trip. So, I mean, there's so many issues that are going to be addressed and that are going to show that our constitution was undermined and the government was undermined. The taxpayers of this country were being taken for a ride.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're going to take a break here. And when we come back, we're going to play one of the more astonishing moments, which, of course, was the testimony of Mthabisi Jonas. And again, just, you know, if you blinked, you might have missed that particular moment, that this isn't just about amassing wealth, but being prepared to even possibly kill someone in order to do so.
702 and Cape Talk.
I had not previously met any of the Gupta brothers, but I recognized him as one of the Gupta brothers from media reports. At the time, I did not know his name, as he did not introduce himself, but simply started talking. I have subsequently looked at press articles which depict the various Gupta brothers. Based on these photographs, I'm relatively certain that the Gupta brother at the meeting was Ajay Gupta. When Mr. Duduzana arrived at Hyatt Hotel, we had a brief discussion. He appeared pretty nervous and spoke in very vague terms. He said nothing of substance, except to say that his father, the then President Jacob Zuma, liked me. After a while, I indicated that I was under pressure, under time pressure. He said that the place was too crowded and that he had important matters to discuss, but that he wanted other people to join the discussion. Mr. Gupta ignored what I said. He said emphatically that I must become Minister of Finance because that is what we want, the we want. By that, I would have to work with them. He also said that if I worked with them, I would become very rich and that he could immediately offer me 600 million. He pointed at Mr. Duduzani and said that they had made him a billionaire and that he had bought a house in Dubai. He said that they worked closely with a number of people, including Lynn Brown and Brian Molefe. At the end of the meeting, Mr. Gupta repeated that they had information on me, and if I suggested that the meeting had okay, they would kill me.
You know, that came out just so casually and nonchalant, but, you know, mostly because Mthabisi is always just so calm.
Calm, yeah.
But actually, I remember going into the producer's booth and saying, did I just hear correctly, guys? Is this what the guy just said? And then you kind of like go on Twitter to make sure that other journalists actually heard exactly what you heard, right? It's amazing. But what comes up for you? Because it shows you this thing was a matter of life and death. And we sometimes think about some of our discussions around state capture in very abstract terms.
True.
It can be deadly.
That's true. I mean, people have lost their jobs through state capture. I mean, the issue of Mthabisi Jonas, you know, his life being threatened was quite serious because, I mean, you can imagine these guys were looting billions and they needed some sort of silence. The mere fact that, you know, they were also able to summon people, ministers, people that are supposed to be representing our taxpayers to their private residence, mm-hmm. is of great concern, including the president himself. But, I mean, he hasn't seen anything wrong with that. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole situation shows how deep that we had sold our country, and the ordinary person was not benefiting from this because some people had access to power. Mthabisi Jonas, I mean, I remember when we tried to confirm the story that particular Saturday when we heard of this. I get to understand now that why he didn't want to talk, you know, before we published the story when I was at the Sunday Time, because you know his life had been also threatened, and I mean, it seems as if the Guptas did whatever they wanted to do.
And they did a pretty good job at it because not only are you busy looting in parts of the state, you also subvert the criminal justice system.
Correct.
And I think one of the most important issues we've got to obviously talk about is what this now means for law enforcement agencies, including for the Hawks that already had all sorts of leadership in other crises at any rate. And over the last week or two, I'm thinking to myself, I mean, it's little wonder that these guys were as brazen as they were, because we've learned from Jacques Poe's book about the parallel way in which the security agencies in this country have been basically outsourced to private interests mm-hmm. when it comes to intelligence. Yes. Now we also find out that even the law enforcement agencies within the criminal justice system themselves were geared up in such a way that these guys could get away with criminality.
Such an injustice, Eusebius. I mean, they managed to capture even the criminal justice system. Only now that with the new Hawks Head and, of course, the new head, the new Don issue, that, you know, somebody has been suspended in the Hawks, you know, that they were trying to, subvert some of the Hawks' investigations.
Yeah.
There are tons and tons of cases relating to state capture that were opened with the Hawks. NPA wasn't moving. The Hawks were not moving. SARS was not doing anything regarding tax-related matters of the Guptas moving so much money out of the country to overseas. And, I mean, Mcebisi Jonas has also alluded to the fact that they told him that, no, we run everything. We will protect you, etc. You know, so that is the injustice that has actually happened throughout the issue of state capture, that you found law enforcement agencies not working and, that they collapsed.
The president's son keeps coming in and out of these testimonies, right? How exactly does he feature?
Look, it brings, you know, the issue closer to home to President Jacob Zuma, that the son seems to have been, you know, the middleman between between government and the Guptas, and it sort of gives this picture and explains why the Guptas were particularly interested in taking Duduzane Zuma to become one of their directors, because clearly he was the one who, you know, was facilitating these meetings, calling people, etc. Excuse me. I mean, I recall in one of the state capture, the Gupta leaks, that, you know, the document that was prepared for former President Jacob Zuma to become a resident in Dubai, it went via Duduzane. And of course, I mean, former President Jacob Zuma denied any knowledge that he actually ever applied to have, you know, a Dubai residency, you know. So, but the link shows that Duduzane Zuma was the key factor in many instances, and hence the Guptas actually got him closer.
So you know, and there's so many questions here that are raised in addition to the ones being answered, but many that are not yet answered. You wonder, for example, when you listen to Fakey Mentor, whether some of the state information that by law private citizens should not actually be in possession of, whether every single one of them would necessarily have come directly from President Jacob Zuma, or whether the steer boy could have been Duduzane himself.
Yeah, I mean, there's also evidence that ministers themselves voluntarily gave documents, you know, confidential cabinet documents to the Guptas. I mean, the Honorable Faith Mutambi is one such person. I mean, on the issue of digital migration, which also indicates that there was a concerted effort to ensure that the Guptas had an unfair advantage. So, and also the advisors that the Guptas were giving to the ministers, they played a role in leaking some of this information. I mean, I can think about the note that was the plan that was created for cabinet by Treasury. Within one day that Des van Rooyen was in office, it leaked to Eric Wood, who in turn sent it to Salim Essa, a Gupta business partner. And of course, I mean, that document ended up with the Guptas. Now, those are illegal acts they could have been charged with.
Yeah.
But nothing happened throughout that time.
Second last question. What about, I used to mockingly refer to him on the show as Maluti Gupta, after Nasrec, the heat has been off on him from a media spotlight point of view. But of course, this is someone who has been in key parts of the state as a minister, and very often by massive, gigantic coincidence, you have Gupta people that suddenly get all sorts of positions, advisory roles, citizenship, etc., etc. Have we learned anything more or less about his culpability?
That word he has created for himself, plausible deniability,
as Zuma has.
I mean, he has a case to answer, though, in certain instances when he was public enterprises minister, in changing the boards, the people, because some of the people
Home Affairs,
the people that he put on the board were actually linked to the Guptas. But I don't have, you know, nobody has some sort of has placed him directly to say, but this and that happened. He has indeed, over the past, created that plausible deniability.
You've partly alluded to what my last question was going to be in relation to Jacob Zuma, but the same applies to also Kigaba, which of course is this notion of plausible deniability. And this is, unsurprisingly, the kind of thing that you find an old hand like Zuma, who was an excellent operative in the underground of the ANC, to understand incredibly, incredibly well. Does this commission, do you think, have the shrewdness, the capacity forensically to be able to ask those questions about these important political principles like Malusi and Jacob Zuma and answer them for us authoritatively? Because the words plausible deniability sound like they come from some sort of spy novel, you know,
or political science in relation to
what happens in shadow states. And that's exactly, of course, what does happen. Will we be able to answer by the end of this commission of inquiry whether there's any constitutional and not just political culpability on the part of Malusi and, respectively, Jacob Zuma?
Look, I mean, you know, it depends on the security clearance issue. And people don't understand why, you know, Judge Zondo keeps on mentioning the issue of the security clearance for investigators, because they need to get access to certain confidential classified documents. Once they are able to do that, we will then be able to, you know, place a number of people on certain that they took these decisions.
Sure.
They instructed so and so. Because, some, I mean, documents that are sent to the president, you know, they're classified, and you need those investigators to get the security clearance. You know, there are many questions around why the delay on the security clearance issues. Are there documents that these guys don't want the investigators to get access to?
In 30 seconds, where does this story move to from here? Journalistically, what are you now looking forward to in terms of the next couple of days or weeks?
Look, I mean, we're trying to establish, as you know, how many other people, you know, are coming and what are they bringing, you know, to the table. You know, are they going to corroborate what has already been said, or are they going to give us new details? Because, I mean, even us as journalists, I don't think we even touched, at the heart of the state capture itself. There's more other people that could come forward and actually surprise
Absolutely.
Us.
Absolutely. Let's see how it plays out. Tanut Xolo, thanks for coming in. Much appreciated.
Super.
Tanut Xolo Jika, of course, investigative journalist with The Mail and Guardian.